Curtis Hill running for governor. Ilearn results show poor scores, plus corn growers worried about electric vehicles, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 14th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, former Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, whose law license was temporarily suspended while in office when the state Supreme Court ruled he criminally battered four women, is running for governor. Hill joins a crowded Republican primary for the open seat. Hill had been seen as a rising Republican star before allegations that he groped four women, including a state lawmaker, at a late-night party in 2018. Despite facing calls to resign and having his law license suspended for a month, Hill remained in office before losing re-election at the state Republican Party convention to current AG Todd Rokita. Hill also lost a bid for Congress last year in a private Republican caucus to replace the late Jackie Walorski. In a statement, Hill says he's running for governor because people want a proven conservative leader who is not beholden to Washington, D.C. or special interest groups. U.S. Senator Mike Braun, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, and Fort Wayne businessman Eric Doden are among the other announced Republican candidates. What is Hill's path to the GOP nomination? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Laura Beck. Republican, Mike O'Brien. O'Shea Boyd, Public Engagement Editor for the Indianapolis Star. And Nikki Kelly, Editor-in-Chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, we often, especially in a crowded primary, we talk about what's the lane? What's the lane to succeed? What is Curtis Hill's lane here?
Well, I think the presumptive right now lane is the religious right base, right? That went to bat for him at the convention, that tried to defend him when all the allegations were flying, and either dismissed him as not that big of a deal, or, you know, kind of said what he said, that it never happened. The question's going to be in a four or five way race, though, with a lot of money in it. You don't need 51% of the vote to get the nomination. You need like 30, right?
And maybe not even that, honestly. With four serious candidates.
Right. With that many serious candidates spread across, you know, all of that. So the question is going to be for that part of the base, do they still have gas in the tank to keep defending this guy? And are they still kind of holding on to that? And there's enough energy behind that to rally around them if they don't see another option? Which may not be true either. You may go see another option in a Mike Braun. You know, Doden, maybe Chambers comes in. Brad Chambers, the head of IDC, maybe he comes in. Those guys kind of fill a business role, and Mike Braun certainly is central to that. Mm-hmm. But he's also, you know, pretty far right on the, you know, as far as the base is concerned. So if that part of the base doesn't see another alternative, then they could rally around Curtis Hill. I don't see that delivering the election for him, but that's the best shot he's got.
In terms of thinking about Curtis Hill's lane, I agree that it does feel like the far right of the party, which is a significant part of the party in this state, didn't have an obvious candidate yet. Maybe Mike Braun, not really Eric Doden. Suzanne Crouch has certainly tried to lean that way in her social media campaign, but that's relatively new, and I don't know that she has the roots in that community the way Curtis Hill does.
Right.
But at the same, and I think it was interesting in the statement I got from the Hill campaign on Monday when he announced, he used the words Washington, D.C., I think, three times. Mm-hmm. So is it Mike Braun that he's clearly going after right now?
Possibly. I mean, I have to say my comments on Curtis Hill are going to be pretty brief because I have Curtis Hill fatigue, if not Curtis Hill exhaustion at this point in time. And I think the most
on
time...
On that we agree.
Exactly. And I was going to say, I mean, I spent considerable time reading all of your tweets from his hearings, both of your tweets from his hearings, and that was about as much as I've had of Curtis since then. I agree with Mike on the fact that he is going to try and get that far right piece. And stranger things have happened in Republican primaries. I mean, we all knew with when Richard Lugar lost, for example, in that primary. And we know how primaries can be on both sides of the aisle. I've been in this business long enough to know that massive egos often outweigh common sense. And they often...
Shame.
I mean, all those things. I mean, and so I just don't know if he's going to be able to raise the money that he's going to have to raise to be competitive. I know a lot of people will say, I'm going to 92 counties. This is going to be about grassroots. But he's going to have a lot of money. And he's going to be up against some really strongly funded folks in the primary, and then you've got Suzanne Crouch, who basically rolls out an endorsement every day,
well,
or every
genuinely,
other day.
Genuinely, so, just about every day.
Yeah, so like. I think his, I don't necessarily know how his path is going to look, but he could complicate things, and that can be really a pain for Republicans.
It feels strange and sad to say this, but I don't think the allegations and the law license suspension and all of that will be the thing that hurts Curtis Hill the most in this primary. Nikki, will it be the fact that he's not just facing three people who will have money. He's facing three people right now who already have a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, they have a ton of money, and he's got a lot of, you know, ground to make up moving in this late with having some baggage. You know, I do think he's sort of banking on, you mentioned him mentioning the Washington, D.C. a lot. He's banking on sort of this national tenor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's almost like he's running for attorney general of the nation instead of governor of Indiana. You know, he's announcing on Fox News Digital, and he's doing all these sort of national conservative hits. So he's trying to, I guess, improve his name ID and maybe draw some money from outside.
And
Indiana.
Not just money, but that gets his face out there to hopefully the kind of audience here in Indiana that he's seeing. Mm-hmm. So making use of the fact that he doesn't right now at least have as much money.
Yeah.
Let me say this, though. Will he have to face head on what happened while he was in office? The fact that the court said he criminally battered these women. Will he have to face that head on in this primary, or can he largely ignore it if that's the route he decides to go?
I think he can try, but if I'm his opponent, I'm going to bring it up as much as I possibly can. And I think that is definitely a weak spot for him. So why wouldn't I take advantage of that? But to your point about the Washington, D.C., I thought that was really strange because I was like, who is he talking about exactly? Who is he signaling to that he, but you've gone on Fox. Nothing you've done is about Indiana. So, but you want to be the governor of Indiana. But I definitely think that his past is going to come back to haunt him. He can try to ignore as much as he wants to and pretend that it doesn't exist, but I think his opponents are definitely going to use it against him.
We had a pretty crowded field at this point in 2003. Mitch came in and kind of cleared that field. Murray Clark, you know, a lot of these guys were, David McIntosh, Luke Kenley, we're all kind of kicking the tires on the governor's race. And what Eric Miller's entrance into that kind of had this moment where it was like, oh, we got to consolidate the same people into one guy, you know, and Mitch was clearly the guy that everybody wanted to consolidate into. So Curtis does bring this element of let's get to the end of the year and maybe Doden and Chambers are sitting in single digits, Hill's sitting at 20. All this is theoretical. You know, Suzanne and Braun are both doing well and competing, but there could be an argument later that, like, hey, we can't scatter this vote five ways.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah.
Because we could wind up with them.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, though, is he could also be trying to burnish his national profile. I mean, he may be angling for a spot on Fox News. Like, he may be trying to be a Fox News commentator at this point in time.
Or in a potential Republican administration after the next election, if that happens.
Yeah.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, who should be the Republican candidate for governor? Mike Braun, Suzanne Crouch, Eric Doden, Curtis Hill, or someone else. And I'll just note that I put that in alphabetical order. There's no sense of favoritism or anything in the order of that list. Last week's question, should the state investigate utility companies' storm recovery efforts? 77% of you say yes, 23% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana students missed out on weeks or months of in-person instruction during the COVID-19 pandemic. And state test results released this week show the disruption is still taking a toll. From WFYI's education desk, Dylan Piers McCoy reports that some students are faring better than others.
Just 3 out of 10 Indiana elementary and middle school students met the state goals for math and English proficiency on the spring iLearn exams. That's substantially below scores before the pandemic. Charity Flores is the chief academic officer with the Indiana Department of Education. She says the overall pace of learning has stabilized. Many students, however, are still struggling.
As systems have returned to those normal rates of learning, how do we ensure that the students have also returned at least to the normal rates of learning?
State officials are particularly concerned about English language learners. About 8% passed the exams this year.
Laura, what is a reasonable expectation for when, or maybe even if, students will fully recover from learning loss from the pandemic?
I wish I had a crystal ball for that. I really do. And I know there are, and as a parent, and I know all of us sitting at this table are parents, and how challenging it is, especially trying to educate your kid during the during COVID and then all of the issues that we were faced. I mean, I think there are some very worthwhile initiatives underway trying to get kids back to a place where we're at a level playing field. But I do think that schools, particularly, they are really fighting a, I don't want to say losing battle, but I mean, they are fighting wars on several fronts, right? You've got the academic piece and educating kids, but then you also have just this massive social upheaval that's taking place. And you've got a mental health crisis underway with young people and their families. You've got people who don't have access to resources. You've got a whole host of issues. And it runs the gamut from private schools to public schools that schools are dealing with and they're trying to face. I think one of my biggest disappointments was this past legislative session that instead of focusing on some really meaningful common sense approaches mm-hmm. that can get kids ahead, we had some Republicans in the legislature who decided to fight culture wars. So they're basically banning books that a lot of kids can't even read at this point in time. And it's incredibly frustrating to see that happen. And you know that on all different sides of the aisle, there are a number of different strategies and initiatives and groups and organizations working to do this. But I feel like with the legislature, they're definitely not helping this at all in any way, case, or shape or form.
The legislature has, we didn't see, I don't think, dedicated money in this budget for learning loss, but we saw that in the wake of in the wake of the pandemic, both in 21, I think, and 22 as well. And obviously that's helped in that the rate of learning has recovered. It seems like sort of systems are back where we need them to be. But are these, you know, we've talked about this before across a lot of different issues. Is this going to be a cohort of students that is always going to kind of be a little behind? And is that okay to a certain extent?
There's a little bit of that. I mean, there's a little bit of that, like, in the legal community with people that took the open book bar exam, right?
Yes.
That's a kind of a, you know, mark on your record. Legislature did try to appropriate and direct those that catch-up money. I think what, and this is COVID generally, right, the way COVID was handled bluntly and without any, you know, post-mortem, you know, pardon the expression, but on what did we do right, and what if this happens again, or when this happens, should we never do again or do differently? And this is one of those things. I think what you're going to find in that cohort is that it's going to be exactly what it always was. It's going to be kids in rural communities. It's going to be kids in poor urban communities that did not have any system built that allowed them to just go home the next day. Mm-hmm. My kids go to Avon. They already had virtual learning. The kids knew how to use that system. You were in person at school on a Wednesday. We're all going home on Thursday until further notice, and no problem. They flipped the computer on, jumped on the internet, and they're doing what they always know how to do.
Right.
And so the kids in those communities have far more opportunity to catch up, and so the resources really should have been dedicated in those areas that we always know kids are behind.
And to that end, something Laura talked about. My wife is works at the public library here in Indianapolis, and what you think a librarian does is the tiniest part
exactly.
of what a librarian does in this country, which is she's a social worker. She's helping people with job applications and benefit applications and a million different things that have absolutely nothing to do with the books that are in the library.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And is that part of this issue, which is the teachers are being expected to do so much more than teach, especially in the rural and poor urban communities where the resources aren't the same anyway? And is that just making all of this harder and harder?
I think it's making it harder, but I also think the people who are making the laws and the people who are deciding what teachers do don't know what teachers actually do. And so, yes, in some place like Avon, maybe your student doesn't have to deal with all the other things, and the teachers don't have to deal with all the other things that teachers in IPS or in Warren or in Wayne are dealing with. But who's making the laws? We have the parents in Hamilton County are complaining about the books. You don't see the parents in IPS complain about the books because it's a different situation of who has the power, and a squeaky wheel always gets the grease. So now we're changing because of parents in communities who don't have all those issues, and they're not thinking about the children who do. So will we see this group improve? I don't know. Did we actually set expectations on what that improvement should actually look like? Did we actually say, okay, here's where they are, here's where we want to be? What do we do that actually, what strategies we do that made sense and actually work? Because you said we didn't do any kind of looking back postmortem and saying, okay, what worked, what didn't work. We haven't had a real plan that I know about to say, okay, and let's even go back further. We were already.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about
these disparities weren't suddenly created. Right.
We've talked about this before when I was on this show. Like, we've already had issues, and I covered education, and I always wondered, why is it that we're teaching Indiana students Indiana standards, and they still don't do well on a test made for Indiana? I've never understood that, and no one's been able to really answer that question for me. So if they're teaching, if you're teaching this, what's going on?
Is that, you know, we've seen so many changes in education policy in this state over the last decade or so, where at times we were talking about the fatigue of that, of like trying to constantly, just constantly moving the target. But right now,
We're still constantly moving the target.
But is it also going to be a lot harder to evaluate what's working and what's not when the scores are, because of the pandemic, lower than we'd like them to be anyway? Is it going to be hard for us, at least for a little while, to go, is this working, or are we just trying to catch up?
What we got to remember is right before the pandemic, we moved from iStep to iLearn, which was a completely different test. Mm-hmm. Now we have streamlined the academic stands. Now we're going to change the test again. Mm-hmm. I will say that the legislature did put some funds into remediation and tutoring, but you know, it was kind of all voluntary, right? I mean, some kids have parents who aren't going to sign them up for that and aren't going to sit next to them
and don't even know about it.
And so I do wonder if, God, I don't want to do compulsory stuff, but, you know, we keep passing these kids from one grade to the other when they can't do basic math and basic English, and then we throw them into calculus in seventh grade.
And it's going to catch up to them at some point, too.
Yeah.
Like, in a really serious way, once they're getting to the point where now it's time for either college or the workforce.
Yeah.
And what are they going to do when they get out there and they're just not as prepared as they need to be? All right. Ethanol producers and corn growers worry that a federal rule on tailpipe emissions could leave them out of the transition to cleaner cars. While car makers could use any technology to comply, the Environmental Protection Agency estimates up to 67% of new cars sold by 2032 would have to be fully electric. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports that could have big implications for Indiana, one of the top ethanol producers in the country.
Several industry groups and state attorneys general oppose the rule. They say the EPA didn't consider the role a number of other technologies could play, like hydrogen fuel cells, hybrids, or cars that can use gas with higher amounts of ethanol. Some of these cars are already on the market, and advocates say these fuels wouldn't require overhauling the country's electric grid. Dan Byers is the vice president of climate and technology with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The reality is that these proposed standards go too far too fast and make the mistake of putting all the transition eggs into the EV basket.
Ethanol advocates say there may not be enough critical minerals available to make those EVs, and the EPA didn't consider the emissions that could come from mining them. Though environmentalists have said the agency often doesn't take into account the land use changes needed to make ethanol and other biofuels.
O'Shea, the move toward electric vehicles on its face should be a really good thing. But is Indiana at risk here?
I will tell you what, I have never thought about this before. but now that you've made me think about it, yes, I think Indiana probably will be at risk because we produce a lot of ethanol. I mean, we're corn. We're a corn state, right? So ethanol is a big deal. But one of the questions I wanted to answer, one of the concerns I had is, we know that things are going to change. We know that what we do this, it's not going to be the way it's always going to be. So as we started seeing more and more electric vehicles, that became the trend. Why wasn't there a plan in place to move more toward that? Why do we wait until we're behind the gun? Now we have to, well, now we got to figure this out. Now we're panicking. We don't want progress now because, you know, it seems to be a very Indiana problem. Now we don't want progress because it's going to harm us. But we saw this coming. I mean, you could read the writing on the wall. This was going to happen at some point sooner or later. So what do we do to actually be progressive but still maintain our the status quo to some extent? Because ethanol is important, and that's good for our economy, right? So what are we going to do here?
Yeah, I mean, agriculture is such a huge, huge economic driver for the state of Indiana, so we can't, you know, even if you live in an area where you haven't seen a farm ever, mm-hmm. it affects your life more than you realize. But to that point that she just made, should they have started these conversations a heck of a long time ago?
Sure. I mean, I think in this case, they do have to take an all-of-the-above approach, and it does seem that, you know, some people want to focus only on electric vehicles and not any other options. I will say that while ethanol is an important part of the economy, I mean, if you listen to Governor Holcomb and the IEDC, if we get a $50 billion EV battery plan, then maybe right. that can, yeah. you know, there are growth opportunities in the other direction as well. Right. So while we might, you know, go down
lose
in one
online,
area,
yeah.
correct.
Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily help those individual farmers.
That's what I was going to say. That farmer's not going to be
it
happy.
It doesn't help those individual farmers, but at the same time, you have to look at the investments that are being made in the EV battery industry. I mean, you've got a $3 billion plant coming into New Carlisle. I mean, those are areas that, mm-hmm. that's coal country, right? Mm-hmm. So that's helping make a transition there. You've got Kokomo, 1,400 jobs, $2.5 billion plant. I mean, that is significant investment. Mm-hmm. And it's not just investment in the EV battery. It's people who are going to go out and have lunch after yeah. on their shift change, people who are going to stop and, you know, hit the McDonald's. So it really has a major economic spillover. And again, yes, those conversations probably should have happened a long time ago.
Or they'll hit the fireworks store that used to be yeah. a gas station.
Exactly, right? It's a great industry there for the fireworks.
The politics of this, there's real policy mm-hmm. concerns, real policy yeah. questions that have to be worked out that affect people's lives. On the political level, because some of this is political, mm-hmm. it feels like right now we're stuck between the Democrats who want to push forward no matter what, because we need major changes to address climate change, and Republicans who in some cases deny that climate change is happening, or are like, well, we can't move too far too fast, so let's right. not really go far at all. Where is the medium, and can we find it?
It's a pretty blunt goal, right? And because it's blunt, it excludes all these other technologies, hydrogen cells, hybrids, and things that are very low emission or no emission, and really puts the focus on battery plants and going and finding the raw materials that it actually takes to build batteries domestically and the chip manufacturing. So all that, as you push towards a new technology being the standard, of course you're going to create industries around that, and you're going to eliminate industries that have been here for a long time. I mean, there's unintended consequences to all of these things, or intended. The CAFE standards that will now have to be updated to coordinate with the EPA through the DOT.
Yeah, it even goes to infrastructure funding, like in a state mm-hmm. like this. We are largely dependent on the gas tax to yeah, fund yeah. roads and bridges.
Yeah, and the legislature is starting to think about that.
And they are. And
pretty
they
seriously.
Are.
But, right. I mean, the CAFE standards, back to unintended consequences, they pretty much eliminated domestic production of small vehicles because they base the efficiency on the size of the car.
Right.
So they just everyone started making pickup trucks.
Right. Yeah. All right, Indiana's revenue situation is beginning to normalize after years of major fluctuations due to the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact. The state closed the books on its fiscal year this week with nearly $3 billion in reserves. State Comptroller Tara Klutz says the state's financial position is the result of strong fiscal leadership.
We had another very productive year with taxpayer refunds going out, historic investments in education, public safety, infrastructure, and economic development.
Office of Management and Budget Director Chris Johnston says while state revenues seem to have found their new normal in the wake of the pandemic, there are worrying signs in people's pocketbooks. Household savings is going down and household debt is going up.
What is that going to mean to sales tax, which when you look at the revenue report is about 50% of our total general fund revenue?
Despite strong reserves, the state did not collect enough to trigger an automatic taxpayer refund. That's in large part because lawmakers spent $3 billion in one-time funding in the new budget. Nikki, you and I have covered a lot of these closeouts. Is this the first one that felt normal in like 4 years?
Yeah, it felt pretty normal. It was pretty ho-hum. But you do still have to dig into those numbers, right? I think, you know, lawmakers were getting a little tired of people being like, well, you got $5-6 billion in the bank. So they did a couple things to make sure that it looks better. A, they spent a lot of money, yeah. one-time money. But B, We would have triggered the automatic taxpayer refund, except that they changed the law this year to not count the education reserves. So they did a little finagling so that it looks a little better on paper. Our revenues are coming in more normal. We're not, like, above projections anymore. But, you know, just dig a little deeper, and there's still some news there.
And 2 years from now, when another automatic taxpayer refund could have been triggered, they've also changed the law that it cannot be triggered in 2 years because anything over $3 billion in reserves goes automatically to paying down that teacher pension fund. So, yeah, no taxpayer refunds for the foreseeable future here in Indiana.
And they did it in a way that they didn't technically take the law out, but they just changed it a little.
Yeah. Lastly, real quick, we want to wish a very happy birthday to Miss Nikki Kelly. This is a big one. I believe you're turning 30 today. Is that?
Yeah, 30.
Happy birthday.
Right.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Laura Beck, Republican Mike O'Brien, O'Shea Boyd of the Indy Star, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcasts and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.